This is Talk is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio. Okay, every time I fly or travel, I try to pick up a Financial Times of London, which used to be one of the last of the independently owned papers that was fairly non-biased, but now they've sold to Nikkei. But that's still, they're still pretty good because they had to do that because all papers are having problems competing with the internet. But, you know, the Wall Street Journal was known as a fairly non-biased paper because you need accurate information to make investments. And it used to be owned by Dow Jones, but now it's owned by Murdoch. So it has fallen by the wayside. So Financial Times, they say, is leans a little bit neoliberal, and I do notice that, and so that's why I did a piece for the news that I was calling the globalization moment, because I've studied globalization and corporations since before the battle in Seattle. I used to listen to, in the 80s, I would listen to a guy named Roy of Hollywood on KPFK in Los Angeles when I was working graveyard as a grocery clerk, and he would play Dave Emery, which was took over for May Brussel, or muckraker journalist. So, and what they were talking about, for instance, is in this globalization moment, what I've found, in my own personal opinion, and please research this stuff yourself. I'm not claiming to be an expert. Please don't take anyone's word for anything. Please research, use your own brain, research this stuff yourself. One of the things that Dave Emery was saying was that the Nazis came to power, and many historians will say this, and you'll hear me say this often in my show. The reason they came to power was because the in World War One, the elite in World War One was basically, the countries that fought in World War One were all cousins of one another. They were still, it was kind of the end of the monarchy period of history, but they still, monarchs still controlled these countries. And so they were all cousins with one another that were fighting in World War One. And Germany was made to pay reparations for the elite instead of the wealthy paying for the war, when they're the ones that gain, if there is any gain at all in war. It's the wealthy that gain because they just shave off profits and loot the treasury. They've done this for years. The middle class of Germany ended up paying for the war instead of the elites. And that's why it ruined the German economy, and that's why the Nazis came to power. And this has repeated itself, in my observation and my opinion, over and over again. And so this article, Argentina, in the Financial Times, and the article on Erdogan, however you want to say his name, in Turkey, are both examples of how they're taken out of that context, neoliberalism, and how the middle class, which we should have a classless society, we should, with no one starving and no one rich enough to launch themselves into outer space, if we had, and with a little bit of conspicuous consumption here and there, if we had just one class of people that everyone lived healthfully, and no elite, it's taken out of the context of how the elite extract money from the economy. Because when you put money in the bottom of the economy, that money tends to come back to you. For instance, even if you spend it on welfare mothers that spend it on beer and cigarettes, I might actually see some of that money. It comes back to me. But when you give it to the wealthy, in trickle-down economics has proven not to work, you're never going to see that money. They just put it in the bank. And what they've done recently is just buy back all their stock just to increase the value of their stock. So to do nothing to help society or the homeless or anything like that. So that's what I couldn't explain this during the news because I'm trying to do shorter pieces for the news. But that's what the globalization moment that you're going to hear about Argentina, Central America, South America, Venezuela was, I'm having a hard time finding this in the memory hole that is the internet, but Trump stopped, I used to buy Citgo gas because that comes from Venezuela, and that would support Central and South America, and not support the Middle East. So I used to go out of my way to go to 7-Eleven and buy Citgo gas. And what my memory was that Trump stopped, made it illegal for Venezuela to sell oil in the United States. And you'll know, and that's partly why their economy collapsed, and that's probably why they ended up with a dictator. And this happens with Gaddafi, and Saddam Hussein wanted to get off the petrodollar. And if you follow the petrodollar, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, you'll see how these institutions fund corporate resource extraction rather than making countries self-sufficient, where we could trade, culture and art and culture, and then you wouldn't have a refugee crisis like you do in Turkey and with us right now. This is why we have these refugee crises. And I'm not saying that you should be able to come over the border anytime you want. But the reason you're seeing these huge influxes is because of war and elite resource extraction. There's a recession after most wars because we have to pay for those wars. And, we bailed out the banks instead of bailing out homeowners in the 2008 financial crisis and then left them unregulated to do the same thing again so that we'll have to bail them out again in the future. You may hear, I've said this before, you may hear Alex Jones talk about neoliberalism, but the solution is not to go to Reaganomics and continue on with state-sponsored corporatism and supply-side economics. That was the wrong way to go. The way to go is to put money in the bottom of the economy. And someday, if you wanted to have a libertarian society, my idea would be a bunch of co-ops where you don't have, where you do have a small government, because the government tends to get out of control and start subsidizing multinational corporations and oligarchs and the elite. And they do, like I say, they do it with war. Orwell said the war is waged by the ruling group against its own subjects, and that's, they just keep shaving money off the top. That money that goes to the military-industrial complex stays in the hands of a few people instead of spreading that money out. Yeah, so Erdogan, Turkey is dealing with the Syrian refugee crisis is why, first of all, he is a dictator and probably not, and Putin too are all dictators. But again, Putin too came to power because the United States allowed the Russian oligarchs to just take the money out of Russia that should have gone to the Russian people and put it in the Bank of England. And my research, again, research this, please research this stuff yourself, but what my research says too is this goes all the way back to the Russian Revolution. The industrialists, the U.S. industrialists, refused to work with the Soviets, and so it ruined their economy. The oil production, which was where they were getting the money to do social programs, collapsed. And which, of course, we shouldn't be using oil for that anyway, because that's the whole point, is we shouldn't be using resource extraction. So, but at the time, that was the only way they could make their economy work. But yeah, this has happened now. This is, again, and Venezuela is a good example. They could use the oil money temporarily, and that's what they were planning to do, is use that oil money to temporarily make profits off it and then become a self-sufficient society. The Netherlands, my own problem with communism is that there's only one entity that runs everything. The Netherlands and the Norwegian countries, most of them, their countries are based on oil. They have been successful socialist countries, but that money has come from oil. And I wonder how successful they would be if they weren't selling the rest of the world oil. But they have, to some extent, used that money to make themselves self-sufficient. And there's really no reason to trade. Globalization has been a complete failure. Anyone who's telling you that it isn't is wrong, and supply-side economics have been a complete failure, and Reaganomics have been a complete failure. And another word on All this money can be used for diplomacy, too. If we use this money to spread the money out and help people with humanitarian aid instead of extracting resources and keeping all the money in the hands of a small group of elite people, you would see much less war. And if there are some wars that really need to happen, if there really are real wars, we could find out which ones they are and resolve them. But instead, we just keep the world in a complete turmoil and we can't figure out what's going on. Like I say, most of these could be solved with diplomacy and spend the money that we spend, the trillions of dollars that we spend on war, on humanitarian aid. And there's a group that's doing that, that I've found is doing that. There's many groups that are doing that, but especially the Poor People's Campaign. And so you're going to hear a little bit from them. They have a whole bunch of demands that you're going to hear, and one of them is to switch. Martin Luther King has for years said to switch military spending to humanitarian aid for the world. And the Poor People's Campaign is not just for black people, it's for people of all colors, all poor people in the world. Also, in my opinion, the Federal Reserve engages in currency manipulation. When the Fed raises interest rates, other countries, people, investors in other countries, and you'll hear a little bit about this in the article, take their money and buy dollars and prop up the dollar and take, but that takes money away from things like the Turkish lira and other countries' currencies. So then they say it's to fight inflation, but now these other countries have to raise their rates even more in order to encourage investment in their countries that they then can use for social programs and things like that. And the IMF ties austerity programs to their loan guarantees. And the other thing is, when interest rates were down here in the United States, that would have been a perfect time. We had zero interest rates. That would have been a perfect time for social programs, to fund those social programs. You would have been able to do them with zero interest. But instead, we let the banks, bailed out the banks, and let them do stock buybacks. But, the IMF, the IMF loans money after U.S. foreign economic policy creates a crisis in these countries and then wants austerity programs, which means that they have low... they want to privatize everything and cut social programs. And check out djsusd.com. This is the globalization moment, where we spotlight stories that are taken out of context of U.S. foreign economic policy that destabilizes developing countries for multinational corporate exploitation, causing death, destruction, and the resulting refugee immigration.
This is from the Financial Times of Monday, July 22nd. Traders pour billions into the Turkish currency as high rates boost returns. By Adam Sampson from Ankara, Mary McDougall, and Costas Morcellis of London. Hedge funds and other traders have pumped billions of dollars into the Turkish lira in recent months. They chase juicy returns, but this has left the country vulnerable to sudden swings in sentiment, say investors and analysts. Money managers have since October poured around $24 billion into trades that seek to profit from Turkey's high interest rates, currently 50%, according to Istanbul-based Barum Çeki Research and Consultancy. Managers borrow the money for the trade in a currency with lower interest rates to maximize their gains while hoping that the exchange rate does not move against them in the meantime. Investors are running at the biggest position in the Turkish lira above the benchmark index, weighing in about 5 years, according to a June survey of JP Morgan clients. A significant portion of the influx has been in the form of fast money flows. Investors such as hedge funds that can rapidly exit in the event of international or domestic shocks, analysts and investors say. The share of fast money in trades like this has been increasing, and that definitely does not make them more prone to reversals, said Kiernan Curtis, head of emerging market local currency debt at fund manager ABRDN. A Turkish economic official who asked not to be named echoed that sentiment, noting that an external crisis such as a surge in oil prices could send fickle investors fleeing. The inflows have come after President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who once called high interest rates the mother of and father of all evil, abandoned his insistence on keeping borrowing costs at ultra-low levels following his re-election in May last year. Turkey's central bank has raised its main interest rate to 50% from 8.5% since last June. The lira has generated total returns, including gains from interest payments, of 18% against the U.S. dollar in 2024, despite a significant depreciation in the Turkish currency, Bloomberg data shows. Few other emerging market currencies have offered such strong total returns. The international inflows have been a major boom for the central bank's effort to rebuild its foreign currency war chest, which was severely depleted in recent years by an unsuccessful attempt to prop up the lira and by high imports caused by intense demand for consumer goods. Net foreign assets, a proxy for foreign exchange reserves, have jumped to $40 billion from around minus $20 billion last summer, according to Financial Times calculations based on central bank data. Net assets strip out some liabilities of the central bank but do not account for short-term borrowing from the local banking sector through swaps. The higher reserves and the central bank's commitment to keeping monetary policy tight will help Turkey fend off any future run on the currency, according to Grant Webster at Investment Manager 91, who said the central bank was in a very strong position to defend against outflows. This is again from the Financial Times of London, Monday, July 22nd. Markets turn against Milei's economic strategy. Argentina's libertarian president Javier Milei is facing the first major test of his plan to fix the country's troubled economy after his moves to control a run on the peso sparked a market backlash. The government sets the currency's official exchange rate at about 960 pesos to the dollar, but on parallel exchange markets, both legal and illegal, the Argentine currency hit a record low of almost 1,500 per greenback this month. The gap between the rates is seen as a key indicator of confidence in the government and can fuel inflation. Last week, Milei unveiled a plan to stabilize the peso. The central bank will tighten rules on money printing to shrink Argentina's money supply and start using its scarce foreign currency reserves to buy pesos on the parallel market. If I turn off all the money printing taps, the problem ends, Milei told broadcaster LN+. Investors do not seem to agree. Argentina's stock market fell as much as 12.3% last week, and its dollar-denominated sovereign bonds as much as 11.3% before paring some losses, as critics dubbed the new measures short-termist and inconsistent. Delays in building up foreign currency reserves will slow the government's plan to lift currency controls, a prerequisite for foreign investment and significant economic growth, and increase the likelihood that Argentina will have to default on more than $9 billion in repayments on its foreign currency debt next year. Milei has delivered on his flagship election pledge to take a chainsaw to Argentina's public deficit in order to bring down sky-high inflation. The monthly inflation rate plunged from 26% in December to 4.6% in June. He argues that keeping the peso strong is key to keeping inflation down. But investors worry that controlling inflation at all costs is now distracting from other ingredients for Argentina's long-term recovery. The removal of currency controls, accumulation of reserves, and access to international capital markets. The government surprised the market with those early inflation and fiscal successes, but now there's a sense that they're running behind events, putting out fires rather than setting the agenda, said Amilcar Kalante, economics professor at the National University of La Plata. The economically unorthodox moves to support the peso would also strain negotiations that Milei recently began with the IMF over a potential new loan for Argentina, which already owes the fund $43 billion, analysts said. Milei has dismissed concerns about his economic plan, laying the blame for exchange rate volatility on Argentine banks. Last week, he accused one of the banks of deliberately trying to destabilize the government by exercising put options, agreements that oblige the central bank to buy back its debt, and forcing the monetary authority to print pesos. Economy Minister Luis Caputo said on Thursday on X that the government's goal has always been to reduce the amount of pesos in circulations. Some are still unconvinced, but reality will show that soon the peso will be a strong currency. Argentines have already faced 3 years of annual inflation above 50%, and Milei has made bringing price pressures down his top priority. To do so, he has halted previous governments' use of money printing to fund spending. To do so, he has halted previous governments' use of money printing to fund spending, pursuing an extreme austerity program. Meanwhile, Caputo, a former Wall Street trader, has advanced a complex plan to clear billions of dollars worth of central bank debt held by local banks and curb the use of money printing to fund interest payments. At the same time, Caputo has tightly controlled the peso's official exchange rate, a key driver of inflation. After a sharp initial devaluation of 52% in December, Caputo has devalued the peso by just 2% a month. Economic activity rebounded slightly in May thanks to agricultural and mining exports, with a 1.3% increase from April, according to official data. But massive contractions continue in domestic sectors such as construction and retail. Milei's bet is that controlling of inflation is the key to maintaining public support for his austerity drive. So far, it is paying off, with his popularity hovering firmly around 51%, according to Sheila Vilker, director of pollster Trespuntozero. But business leaders increasingly complain that Caputo's slow devaluation policy is hurting exports' competitiveness. They ought to correct the exchange rate and warn that inflation will go up temporarily to improve the balance for the external sector, billionaire property developer Eduardo Constantini told local television last week. Sources of dollars exist, but tapping them is difficult. Crucial agricultural exporters, Argentina's main source of foreign exchange, have so far been discouraged from selling their stock by low international commodity prices, compounded by the uncompetitive exchange rate. Some $21 billion worth of exportable grain is sitting in storage, according to calculations by Argentina's Rural Society Agribusiness Lobby. An investment incentive scheme approved by Congress last month could pull in dollars via the energy and mining sectors, while the government claims an imminent tax amnesty will bring in some $1.5 billion. Analysts say the government is pinning much of its hopes on the idea that the IMF will agree to lend Argentina more cash to help it exit currency controls, particularly if Donald Trump, who Milei claims as an ideological ally, wins November's election in the U.S., the fund's main stakeholder. But the government's decision to use its reserves to prop up the peso will make a deal harder to reach, given that the IMF has criticized such practices. Argentina is already the IMF's largest debtor and the recipient of the most IMF bailouts in history.
This has been the Globalization Moment, where we highlight stories taken out of the context of U.S. currency manipulation and state-sponsored corporatism. For KEPW News, I'm DJ Susti. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's policy toward Palestinians continues to eschew international law.
This is from the Financial Times of London from Monday, July 22nd. UAE says it is willing to join multinational force in Gaza after war ends, by Andrew England and Chloe Cornish from Abu Dhabi. The United Arab Emirates has signaled it is willing to send forces to a multinational stabilization mission for Gaza after the Israel-Hamas war, becoming the first nation to say it could deploy boots on the ground in the Strip. The Gulf state said it could deploy its forces if the U.S. provides a leadership role and supports steps towards a Palestinian state. The comments by Lana Nusselbey, special envoy to the UAE Foreign Ministry, come as Arab states and the West struggle to devise a viable post-war plan for Gaza. Nusselbey told the Financial Times that Abu Dhabi had discussed the plans with the U.S. as a step to fill the vacuum in besieged Gaza and address its massive humanitarian and reconstruction needs. She said the UAE would only take part if invited by the Palestinian Authority, the Western-backed body that administers limited parts of the occupied West Bank. The UAE could consider being part of the stabilization forces alongside Arab and international partners at the invitation of a reformed PA or a PA led by an empowered prime minister, Newspace said. The United States should have the lead on this for it to succeed. Abu Dhabi had and continued to have conversations on the day after with all the concerned actors in the region. The Gulf state normalized relations with Israel in 2020 and has maintained communication with the Jewish state since Hamas's October 7th attack triggered the war and Israel's retaliatory offensive in Gaza. Details of the mission, including whether it was a military or police force, were still being discussed. The U.S. has been encouraging Arab states to take part in a multinational force for Gaza as part of its post-war planning, but it is not expected to deploy American troops. Diplomats have previously said that Egypt, which shares a border with Gaza, and Morocco, which normalized ties with Israel in 2020, were also considering the plan. In May, the Arab League called for a UN peacekeeping force to be deployed in Gaza and the West Bank until a Palestinian state was established. But the notion has been met with skepticism, as the deployment of any force would face massive hurdles and depend on Israel's actions. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has repeatedly rejected any moves towards a Palestinian state. He refuses to countenance any role for the PA in Gaza and insists Israel will retain overall security control there. He has also rejected Hamas's demands that Israel withdraw its troops from Gaza at talks mediated by the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt to halt the conflict and secure the release of Israeli hostages. Other Arab officials have expressed concerns about being seen as entering Gaza on the back of Israeli tanks and the risks of being drawn into fighting an insurgency there. However, Nusbay said the alternative to the stabilization mission was, quote, to do more of the same, and that will only lead to more violence, radicalism, and suffering for both Palestinians and Israelis. The UAE is considered to have one of the best-trained Arab armies. It is one of the few states to have a presence on the ground in Gaza as it operates a field hospital in the Strip and delivers aid.
On Counterspin, Janine Jackson spoke with American Jewish writer, activist, and political commentator Phyllis Bennis about American complicity in the Israeli genocide.
Well, in this context, and, you know, whatever we say is the latest news might not be the latest when folks hear it, but what I'm reading now says that the International Court of Justice, the top court of the UN, is going to issue in 2 days, on July 19th, an opinion, a non-binding opinion, on the legality of Israel's decades-long occupation of Palestinian land, which is clearly the context here, given our understanding that conflict didn't start on October 7th. Given what we've just said, what can we possibly imagine will come from that opinion from the ICJ?
What we are going to hear, I anticipate, will be a full recognition of the main violations that Israel is committing in carrying out this 55-year occupation of Palestinian land, the West Bank, Gaza, occupied East Jerusalem. That will not lead, I'm afraid, to a change on the ground. Israel has made clear it has no respect for the International Court of Justice. It has no intention of abiding by decisions of the International Court of Justice. What we are going to hear is a globally legitimated, important, very important judgment, which will be important for us in civil society to hold up as a tool in our own mobilization in our own countries. Those of us in the United States will have a new piece of evidence of the illegality of U.S. arms to Israel because of the illegality of the occupation that those arms are designed to maintain. That's what makes it important. It's going to be a tool for us. International law, like domestic law, frankly, is almost never self-enforcing.
Right.
You know, you can pass a law that says whatever you want, that murder is illegal. Okay,
exactly.
That's good to say.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't stop somebody from killing someone.
Right.
But it does allow accountability. And this will allow accountability. Other countries, not the United States, I'm afraid, but other countries that have a greater commitment to international law than this country does, will be able to use that judgment to, for example, use the concept of universal jurisdiction to say that those crimes, if indeed they are identified by the International Court of Justice, as I anticipate, that those crimes are so serious that they can be adjudicated in any court in any country. And that means that in any country, there could be a trial begun, charges brought against those in Israel, in the government, in the military, in the settlements, in the corporations, who are enabling and profiting from this occupation. And there can be papers issued that will hold them accountable and mean that if they land in Paris or in Brussels or in Pretoria or in countries anywhere in the world who take this up, that they could face arrest for these violations. This is not the International Criminal Court, but the concept of universal jurisdiction means that any court can take up a case like this for these kinds of crimes. So I think it's going to be a very important judgment, even though we can know ahead of time that Israel will certainly not abide by whatever it demands.
And I do want to say that I have seen media pay maybe more respectful attention to international bodies than in the past. You know, it mm-hmm. used to be that the UN was just kind of a joke and they were just people who were trying to interfere with the US. And I feel it's impressionistic, but I feel like that is maybe shifting for just the reasons you say.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think the South African initiative at the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, has played a huge role in that. I think people all around the world, including here in the United States, the most cynical, were cheering and crying, tearing up, watching this dream team of extraordinary rainbow combination of people of the South African legal team argue their case passionately but with great focus on the law. This was about the law. They were not using designer videos or whatever to emphasize the horror of the what the genocide looks like on the ground. They were sticking to the law. And it was a powerful description. And I think people all around the world were looking at that and saying, wow, here's South Africa, a country of the global south, that is suddenly taking the initiative in this institution that for so long was assumed to belong to the wealthy colonial countries of the world. And now suddenly it's being democratized. These institutions themselves are being democratized through this process. That's enormously important. Hamas has violated international law in a number of ways in terms of its attacks using missiles that cannot be targeted against military targets. But the notion that there somehow is this choice of Hamas fighters to fight in the open, as if there is massive open space inside the Gaza Strip, this most crowded strip of territory in the world. It boggles the imagination, on the one hand, to anybody who's ever seen Gaza, this notion that this is somehow a legitimate excuse that, oh, well, it's too crowded. We had no choice but to destroy all the infrastructure, all the buildings, the water treatment, the hospitals, all the universities, every museum, 70% of the schools. This is a constant violation of international law in which our own government and our tax money and our Congress and our president are directly and deeply implicated. We have managed to rebuild the definition of ceasefire so that when we call for a ceasefire, and I've got to say, the message discipline of this broad and largely unaccountable movement mm-hmm. has been pretty extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is sticking to the demand. We need a ceasefire now. At the same time, we have managed to transform the understanding of what does a ceasefire mean? It's not just stop firing for a few minutes while you exchange some hostages and then go back to war. It means a permanent stop to the firing. It means access, real access, to massive amounts of immediate humanitarian aid. And it means stop sending weapons. So when we demand a ceasefire of the Biden administration, we're demanding all those things. Unfortunately, when President Biden says we need a ceasefire, he's only talking about part of one of those three things. And he's undermining the others by continuing to send the weapons. So that's what we have to focus on. The hope is we have more people supporting the rights of Palestinians to life, among other things, is huge. And the responsibility that comes with that hope is to keep up the demand for an immediate ceasefire with all that that requires.
The following quote can be attributed to Tirana Hassan, Human Rights Watch Executive Director. In a historic ruling, July 19, 2024, the International Court of Justice has found multiple and serious international law violations by Israel towards Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory, including, for the first time, finding Israel responsible for apartheid. The court has placed responsibility with all states in the United Nations to end these violations of international law. The ruling should be yet another wake-up call for the United States to end its egregious policy of defending Israel's oppression of Palestinians and prompt a thorough reassessment in other countries as well. Counterspin can be heard on KPW on Tuesdays at 9 a.m. For KPW, I'm DJ Sus D. On Thursday, August 18th, citizen concerned with increased houselessness and founding member of the Barefoot Defenders, Jetty Eddy, appeared before the Eugene Municipal Court for a complaint amendment trial where two charges, interference and obstruction, were added to her two trespass charges. Those two additional charges were for allegedly disrupting a recent city council meeting. The police were afraid to serve her at the courthouse on 11th and Lincoln because of protests by a handful of people outside the courthouse. Eddy refused to be served at her house by police, so she was ordered by the judge to go to the police station to be ticketed. It's unclear if she would have been able to be ticketed for the council disturbance if she was not currently on trial for the original criminal trespass citation she received for helping move the unhoused from the railroad tracks on Union Pacific property. A date was set for October 1st for a settlement conference, presumably to reduce Eddie's penalties in exchange for her stopping her activities surrounding the unhoused. An additional trial date for October 17th was set if the settlement conference yields no results. Eddie said she was worn out from her court appearances and dealings with the police, but does not plan to stop assisting those in need. In the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision that moving indigent populations against their will is not cruel and unusual punishment, unhoused advocates are suing municipalities, citing their cruel and unusual punishment clauses in their local constitutions. There's a discrepancy between various iterations of cruel punishment, cruel or unusual punishment, and cruel and unusual punishment. They're hoping criminalization of the homeless doesn't become the usual punishment. On July 22, 2024, a group of protesters allegedly disrupted city council meetings, chanting "Stop the sweeps" and "End death on the streets." This happened after the city council of Eugene illegally swept a homeless camp for the third time in a row in less than a week without proper warning. Three protesters were detained immediately after the meeting. On August 1, 2024, three people were targeted, arrested, jailed, and charged with disorderly conduct and disrupting a city council meeting. They're asking for people to come show support during their arraignment in the forms of packing the courts, protesting outside the courts, and donating to Eugene jail support at Venmo at Eugene Bail Fund. According to the Poor People's Campaign, poverty and inequality kill 250,000 people every year in America. From Alaska to Arkansas, the Carolinas to California, Mississippi to Maine, Kansas to Kentucky, the Bronx to the border, Appalachian haulers to Apache sacred lands, people are coming together to organize their moral outrage against systemic racism, poverty, ecological devastation, militarism, and the war economy, and the false narrative of religious nationalism into a powerful moral fusion movement. There are 140 million people who are poor and struggling against these injustices in the richest country in the world. A society sick with these interlocking injustices needs a voice rooted in our deepest constitutional and moral values to remind us of who we are and who we must be. In 2018, the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for revival, set forth a comprehensive moral agenda based on the needs and demands of the 140 million. For years, they've been shifting the narrative and building power among the poor to create a compelling moral force for broad and bold systemic change. Hundreds of thousands of people took action and forwarded these moral policy priorities to Congress and their state governors.
What happens in Wall Street often doesn't say a thing about what's happening on the real streets of America.
Everybody
has a right.
Has a right.
To live.
To live.
The Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, has come up with a series of demands.
I know that you are here for the same reasons we all are here, to put our elected official on notice. Yeah.
The pain and the discontent is real, and the demands of our movement are moral.
We know what we want to focus on. Our agenda is clear.
We demand an immediate implementation of federal and state living wage laws. We demand
the right for all workers
to form and join unions.
We demand
equal pay
for equal work.
We demand
a guaranteed annual income.
We demand
fully funded
anti-poverty programs
that protects the welfare of us all.
We demand the expansion of Medicaid in every state. We want single-payer universal health care, not for some, but for everybody.
Restoration of the Voting Rights Act. We demand an end to racist gerrymandering.
We want early registration of 17 and 18 year olds. We want registration to vote at age 18. If we can be drafted for war at 18, we ought to be able to vote automatically at 18. Early voting in every state, same day registration, and the enactment of Election Day as a holiday.
We demand a reversal of state laws that prevent municipalities from raising minimum wage.
We demand an end to mass incarceration and the continuing inequalities of black, brown, and poor white people with the criminal justice system.
We demand the right to vote for the formerly incarcerated.
Yeah.
A clear and just immigration system. This includes providing a timely citizenship process that guarantees the right to vote.
We demand
the First Nation, Native American and Alaskan Native people retain their tribal recognition as a nation, not a race.
We demand
decent housing.
We demand relief from crushing household, student, and consumer debt.
We demand
equity in education. We demand an end to the resegregation of schools. We demand free tuition at public colleges and universities, and an end to profiteering on student debt. Equitable funding for historically black colleges and universities.
We demand the repeal of the 2017 federal tax law. And we demand that the wealthy and corporations
pay their fair share.
We demand an end to military aggression and warmongering. We demand a stop to privatization of military budget and any increase in military spending. We demand a ban on assault rifles and a ban on the easy access of firearms. We demand an end to federal programs that send military equipment into local and state communities. We demand that the call to build a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border be ceased.
We demand a ban on fracking, mountaintop removal, coal mining, coal ash ponds, and offshore drilling. We demand a ban on all new pipelines. refineries and coal, oil, and gas export terminals.
We are demanding that we stop the war on our poor.
Somebody's hurting my brother, somebody's hurting our sisters, and it's gone on far too long, and we won't be silent anymore.
We believe that we can win. For more information, go to poorpeoplescampaign.org. For KPW News, I'm DJ Susti.
My God. This is actually the beginning.
Thank you. Yeah.
Eugene, Oregon.